Good morning, everyone. I think we reached page 491. This is Canto 3 of the Book of Yoga. In search of her soul, Savitri has begun to enter the inner countries. And the first realm that she comes to is a realm of subconscious matter, living matter, the matter of the body. And there's all kinds of elemental entities, small beings. When she is able to move a little further, then she comes into the realm of the senses. Everything is there, but nothing in its place, says Sri Aurobindo. And all these sense impulses, she sees a mob of visions. There's a clash of cries and calls. Nothing is in harmony. Feelings come to the heart, but each of them cares for nothing but its ego's drive. So all these different aspects are pushing and pulling at her. Their impulse is to be free of mind. Mind controls these impulses in us as human beings, but all these senses and feelings, these elemental entities, they want to be free of that control. They think that then they will really enjoy. But Sri Aurobindo says, body without mind has not the light, the rapture of spirit sense, the joy of life. Everything becomes subconscious, shadowy. Inconscience puts its seal on nature's page. There's a lack of consciousness, insensitivity, or else a mad disorder whirls the brain, posting, moving swiftly along the roads of a ravaged nature. Nature is destroyed and suffering. A chaos of disordered impulses in which no light can come, no joy, no peace. This state now threatened, this she pushed from her. I think that's where we stopped. Yes? So that's page 491, 914.
Helmut said we enter 490 down.
Because
I'm leaving it at
28.
So somebody can read. And Margaret, you read to there, to line 128. 100. I will read it. As if in a long, endless, tossing street, one driven mid a trampling, hurrying crowd, hour after hour she trod without release, holding by her will the senseless mute at bay. Out of the dreadful press she dragged her will and fixed her thought upon the Saviour name. Then all grew still and empty. She was free. A large deliverance came. A vast, calm space. A while she moved through a blank tranquility of naked light from an invisible sun, a void that was a bodiless happiness, a blissful vacuum of nameless peace. There's a chair here. Do you have a book? Page 491. I just stopped reading at line 126. Anybody wants to ask anything about this sentences I just read? No, I'm not going to answer this question. No, no, I mean, I'm just not going to answer it. The Saviour name. It can be different for anybody, everybody. Yes, Lorraine. Yes, there were all these subconscious influences, entities, feelings. So everything becomes calm and still. She's free of that state. It's actually a kind of madness that is threatening. A disorder, no? This mad disorder whirling the brain. Perhaps we have passed through some moments like that when we are so confused and there are so many different suggestions coming. And, yeah? So at that time, what we need more than anything is peace. And that can be gained by keeping all that. He says the senseless mute. This is a word from French, which means a pack of hounds. So these things are chasing her, tearing at her. She keeps them at bay. The animal who's being hunted, he will try to keep the hounds at bay. Far enough away, they can bay, they can growl and bark at him without touching him. And out of this dreadful press of thoughts and impulses, she dragged her will and concentrated her thought upon the Saviour name, which represents whatever is the most powerful mantra for each one. Then all grew still and empty. She was free. Yes.
We noticed that he went through the most difficult and the most negative to come up.
Yes.
But here we see that it's very contrary. Like she just she fixed her thought upon the name and she was free.
This also happened with Asvapati. By keeping in his mind the Saviour name, he was able to remain free from all those influences. But I think I mentioned last week that the difference between Asvapati's yoga and Savitri's yoga is that he was passing through all the planes of existence as a representative of the human race. So what he had to experience was the realm of universal evil and falsehood and death. But when he got the key, when he got the clue, then just like this, immediately he was in the paradise of the life gods. He didn't have to go anywhere or do anything. when he got the clue, when he found the clue, then immediately he was projected into those blissful worlds where he was healed of all his inner wounds. But Savitri's search for the soul, it's a parable for all of us. And she is searching for her soul within the material body. So if we go into the inner worlds of the body, we may enter the subconscious layers and levels, and then there are further experiences to come. So that's when we might perhaps experience something like this, of extreme inner confusion and suggestions coming.
Yeah, also often in mother's agenda, no? When the mother experiences a difficult event and she's clinging on the Lord's name, then...
So we'll go around this way. Amitoj, will you read? Huh?
While she moved through a blank tranquility of naked light from an invisible sun, a void that was bodiless happiness, a blissful vacuum of nameless peace. But now a mightier danger's front drew near, and the press of bodily mind, the inconscious brood of aimless thought and will had fallen from her. Approaching loomed a giant head of life, ungoverned by mind or soul, subconscious vast. It tossed all power into a single drive. It made its power a might of dangerous seas. Into the stillness of her silent self, into the whiteness of its muse of space, a spate, a torrent of speed of life, broke like a wind-lashed driven moor of waves, racing on a pale floor of summer sand. It drowned its banks, a mountain of climbing waves.
Maybe we pause there. So she's able to become free of that press of bodily mind, consciousness of the body, and this brood, these children of the inconscient, all these entities of aimless thought and will. This has fallen away from her. But now there's a greater danger approaching, a giant head of life. And it comes like a tsunami, rushing into the stillness of her silent self. It comes as a spate, a flood, a torrent, like a many, many waves driven by the wind and racing on a pale floor of summer sand. So sometimes in the desert we find these wadis or canyons that are dry during the summer. But then a little rain comes in the hills and such a big flood will come and even wash away the banks. I remember in Israel staying in a place that was on the edge of such a wadi, and we didn't have rain, but in the hills there must have been rain. And the people, the farmers, they had built up the banks. They knew it would happen in the winter. And they planted all their crops along the sides, made big buns with stones and earth. Carefully they had made all that. But when the flood came, it just washed it all away and the fields and everything. We could stand on the height and see all our hard work being washed away. So it comes, the waves come like that. It drowned its banks, a mountain of climbing waves. This is a really powerful, irresistible force. The force of life.
compassionate voice. It cries to her listening spirit as it ran, demanding God's submission to chainless force. A deaf force calling to a status dumb. A thousand voices in a muted vast. It claimed the heart's support for its clutch of joy, for its needs to act the witness soul consent, for its lust of power, her neutral being seen. Into the wideness of her watching self, it brought a grandiose gust of breath of life. Its turned carried the world's hopes and fears. All life, all nature's dissatisfied hungry cry, and the longing all eternity cannot fill.
Thank you. There are always these two aspects, not the active and the passive, the dynamic and the status. Here it is life force, which doesn't listen to anything. There's something witnessing it, that status, there's some consciousness there, but it doesn't express itself. It's not going to offer, exercise any control over this deaf force which is demanding God's submission. That's how it's crying out to Savitri's listening spirit. She is just observing, not responding, seeing all this happening. It's claiming for the heart's support. But I think as we look down, we see that her spirit, her heart, doesn't make any response to this call. It just remains silent. But I can't say really what is this dumb status. You have any idea, Jean-Yves? No. Larry?
Well, doesn't it sound like she has this space where she was empty, she was free.
Yes.
Right? And but then
into that empty space,
life.
Force of life. And this is the life force ungoverned. And it wants to control, carry everything with it off in its flood.
And so here is her, well, it sounds like she doesn't have any choice, but she does, doesn't she?
Well, at first what she does is she notices this happening. And Sri Aurobindo's making us notice what is happening, and he's going to give quite a long description of what is the message that this force is carrying. But we read this, no, that it it's actually on the bottom of the next page, 494. It says that she was there like an island, a high and voiceless isle, and all this huge flood, it surrounds her and then it flows away. She's not moved or disturbed by it, but she sees it, she experiences it.
The answer is in that line 141. The status dumb is this listening spirit.
Is it a listening spirit, maybe? Yes.
It remains quiet because it can't really respond to all this ruckus that's going on.
Yes, it may be that. So, but what's interesting for us is to see what is it, what is this force of life doing? It's demanding God's submission to chainless force. It wants to carry everything with it. It expresses itself as 1,000 voices, and they are all claiming the support of the heart. What it's doing is clutching at joy in so many different ways. And it needs to act. It can't be still. It's such a powerful force that it doesn't want to remain still. No? So it wants the witness soul to consent to its demand for action that will bring bliss. It wants power. She wants her neutral being to agree to that.
This force is a cacophony.
Yes. Yes. The 1,000 voices. And it comes also like a powerful wind, a grandiose gust of the breath of life. It's also like a cyclone coming. And then he describes everything that it's carrying. That torrent, that flood, is carrying the world's hopes and fears. All lives, all nature's dissatisfied, hungry cry, and the longing all eternity cannot fill. Insatiable longing. Marie, you'll read on.
It called to the mountain secrecies of the soul, and the miracle of the never dying fire. It spoke to some first inexpressible ecstasy, hidden in the creative heat of life. Out of the nature unseen, leaps the torrent. Its lure and magic, it disordered bliss of disordered bliss. Into earth light, for it made a tangled charm, a bloody drop of nature's primitive joy. And the fire and mystery of forbidden delight, drawn from the world liberty's boundless love. And the honey sweet poison wine of lust and death, a dream to vintage of glory, of life's God, and felt as celestial rapture's golden stream.
Thank you. So it's calling to the mountain secrecies of the soul, the highest levels, and the miracle of the never-dying fire, the intensity of bliss that is there, no? On the mountain secrecies of the soul. And it's speaking to some first inexpressible ecstasy that's hidden in the creative beat of life, that spark of divine delight which has given rise to life. Something inexpressible is there, hidden in the creative beat of life. But it's actually tearing all its force out of the never unseen deeps of the subconscious and the inconscient. So there it brings its lure, its attraction and magic of disordered bliss. And it's pouring all that into earth light, all the maze of tangled charm of life, the heady draft. This is a drink that intoxicates you, makes your head whirl, that wine of nature's primitive joy. And there's all that attraction, that fire and mystery of the forbidden delight that can be drunk from this well bottomless well of the world libido. You can explain to us, Larry, what is the libido, no? The desire self or the pleasure self. Usually sexual desire. All the lower desires.
And drives,
yes. So that's bottomless. And the honey sweet poison wine of lust and death. Those things taste so good. They are dreamed, they are believed to be a vintage of glory of life's gods. The vintage, it's the wine that's made in a particular year. And some vintages are much more powerful and delicious than others. This is felt to be the vintage of the life gods of paradise. It's felt like the golden sting. There's a kind of sting that goes with it. It's believed to be celestial rapture, the rapture of the gods, but it's a poison wine.
Doesn't this sound like the force of nature, the force of life, is pulling those suppressed, because many of these...
It's carrying them with it. It's so powerful.
Pulling it out.
Touring it.
Your consciousness, bringing it to the surface.
Yes. Yes. Exactly. And it doesn't have the capacity to make a difference between the poison wine and the real celestial rapture. Patricia, you'll go on.
The cycles of the infinity of desire and mystique that made an unrealized world wider than the known and closer than the unknown, in which Kant built the hounds of mind and life, tempted a deep, dissatisfied urge within to long for the unfulfilled and ever far, and make this life upon a limiting earth a climb towards summits matching in the void, a search for the glory of the impossible. It dreamed of that which never has been known. It grasped at that which never has been won. It chased into an Elysian memory the charms that flee from the heart's soon lost delight. It dared the force that slays, the joys that hurt, the imaged shape of unaccomplished things, the summons to a Circean transmuting dance, and passion's tenacity of the corpse of love, and the wild beasts ramp and romp with beauty and life.
Thank you. Yes, I'm looking at this difficult sentence. Sora, there are the cycles going around and round, repeating themselves, of the infinity of desire. And then there's the mystique, the mysterious process that has made an unrealized world. This life that we live in is unrealized. It has great possibilities which have not yet been realized. And it has aspects to it that are much wider than all that we know. But it also has these aspects which are much closer to us than what remains to be explored, the unknown. We have the feeling that close to us there are wonderful possibilities if we could only just touch them. But that's another aspect of this unrealized world. And in this unrealized world, hunting for knowledge, for bliss, for realization, for fulfillment, there are the hounds of mind and the hounds of life. So Savitri is feeling this now, that there's this unrealized world and this hunting of the hounds of mind and life, these cycles of the infinity of desire, the mystique that has set up this whole situation, this mystery. And she sees that what it does in her, in human beings, is to tempt, to attract, to stir a deep, unsatisfied, dissatisfied urge within. That in us which is not satisfied with what is known or even with what is unknown, which wants more, always more. That's such a characteristic of the deeper life urges, no? To long for the unfulfilled, for the ever far. And that's not an entirely negative thing. That's the source of aspiration, no? That's the source of those deep urges in us which want to make this life upon this limiting earth something worthwhile, that will bring satisfaction, that it will make this life a climb to ever higher summits of experience and achievement, turn it into a search for the glory of the impossible.
You're such a Don Quixote, Quixotic.
And in fact, that's what's helping to drive our evolution forward. It seems quixotic and it seems meaningless, but actually, that's the dynamism that's driving things forward. So that even in its distorted forms, the Lord doesn't say no to it. Because it carries a positive possibility as well.
I would like to ask about any elucidation on the cycles of the infinity of desire, and the relationship of these hounds,
cycles suggest time. So there's no end in time and space to these cycles. These cycles are movements which come and endlessly repeat themselves. And the cycle of desire is that we want something and we get it, and we are still dissatisfied, we want something else. So it's this endless longing for the unfulfilled and far. But this is a whole world. We can say it's a life world. Maybe it's the life aspect of this world that we live in. And hunting for some satisfaction, for some fulfillment in this world of cycling desire. There are these hounds, the forces in us of mind and life, which are hunting for achievement, satisfaction, fulfillment. You can hear him hunting. And it takes a lot to satisfy him. Yes, Andres.
What's a hound?
A hound is a hunting dog. It sniffs. And in the Vedas, it's symbolized by the goddess Sarama, a goddess of intuition. She shows the way. And he speaks here about Asvapati's will being a hunter on the tracks of light, you know, following that.
The hound of heaven, Sarama. So she's like God is always after us.
So Patricia read a bit further, no? That deep, unsatisfied urge is dreaming of what has never been known. It's grasping for what has never been won. And it has some kind of memory, an Elysian memory. The Elysian fields are the fields of heaven. So from heaven it has a memory of a kind of charm, of delight, that our human hearts are dreaming of, but they never catch it because it's a heavenly thing. Here we have delight, little touches of delight now and again, maybe even often, but they lose that Elysian charm that would be really satisfying. So that makes this deep urge dare dangerous things, the forces that slay and the joys that hurt, that are painful to us and to others. It's always searching for that ultimate delight. It follows the imaged shape, the imagination of unaccomplished things, things that have never been done. And it feels the summons to a Circean dance. Circe is an enchantress in Greek mythology. In the story of Ulysses, of Odysseus, he comes with his men to an island. It seems so delightful. The air is full of music and perfume. And he sends some of his sailors to go and explore the island and find out, come back and report. But they don't come back. And he sends another lot, and they don't come back either. So he has to go himself, very, very circumspectly. And he finds that they have discovered a marvelous table in a beautiful clearing. It's all laid with delicious things to eat. And they've been at sea forever, you know, for almost 14 years. And there are invisible hands that put more delicious things on the table. So, of course, those poor, hungry sailors, they can't resist, and they start to eat the food. And then each of them is turned into an animal. So there they are all, lying around like pigs. So he has to rescue them. He has to master the goddess Circe, the goddess of that place, so that she will turn his people back into human beings and let them go away. So it's a Circean dance is one that changes you into an animal.
What does he do to
he makes her fall in love with him. That's all you can do with these witches.
Sorry, yeah.
Ramp and romp, yes, it's so nice. This again, it's what animals do. Ramping is when they're angry, and romping is when they're playful. Kittens romp. Children can also romp. But a ramping lion, he's on the attack. So within us there is this beast who likes to ramp and romp with beauty and life. And the courts of love, this phrase is very evocative of the early Middle Ages in Europe. There was at least a literary tradition. I don't know how far it was actually acted out in practice. It was a time when most of the noblemen, the aristocratic families, they were all off in Syria and Jerusalem fighting the infidel. And so their wives, the ladies, the princesses, they were all left in charge of the castle. There would be some knights there defending it. And in that context, there arose a special kind of love poetry, which was based on the idea of platonic love, in which there would be no sexual exchange, but the knight was a servitor, a faithful worshipper of the unattainable lady. And this, in theory, was something very ennobling. It turned them into civilized human beings instead of wild beasts. And it seems it's very interesting that out of this, or connected with this literary development, has come the worship of the Virgin Mary. That she's the ultimate unattainable, lovable person, ultimately pure. These are in some way connected. So when we read about the courts of love, that was supposed to be a very pure and disinterested kind of love and worship and service. But here he says what life wants to bring into it is passion. He wants to bring passion to live temporarily in those courts of love. It's nice that he puts these two things together in one line. Patty, you would go on.
It brought its cry in a surge of opposite powers, its moments of the touch of luminous flames, its flame ascensions and sky-pitched vast attempts, its fiery towers of dream built. Of dream built on the winds, its sinkings towards the darkness and the abyss, its honey of tenderness, its sharp wine of hate, its changes of sun and cloud, of laughter and tears, its bottomless danger pits and swallowing gulfs, its fear and joy and ecstasy and despair, its occult wizardries, its simple lines and great communions and uplifting moods, its faith in heaven, its intercourse with heaven. These powers were not blunt with the dead weight of earth. They gave ambrosious taste and poisonous sting. There was an ardor in the gaze of life that saw heaven blue in the gray air of night. The impulses Godward soared on passion's wings.
Thank you. All this is described in much more detail in Book 2, Canto 6, The Kingdoms and Godheads of the Greater Life. But there he emphasizes, as he does here, these opposite powers. There's the upper impulse and the downward impulse, and they contradict each other, and they seem to be equally powerful, this duality in life which is evoked here. And now Savitri is experiencing this in the inner worlds. We experience it, we can even recognize these cries and surges. We experience them in our material world. But here, they are blunt with the dead weight of earth. Blunt, not sharp, no? There, they are not blunt with this weight of matter that weighs down our senses. They are much more intense. So they give the taste of ambrosia, the food of the gods that keeps them immortal. And the sting of deadly poison. And the way that this life force looks at everything, it tends to see everything in a very intense and beautiful way. It sees heaven blue in the grey air of night. And the impulses seem to have a divine sort of power. They soar towards God, soaring up like big, powerful birds because they have this passion, this intensity, this life force. In most spiritual paths, an attempt is made to avoid all this intensity. It's felt to be very dangerous. It is very dangerous. But nowhere does Sri Aurobindo reject the life force. And there's a very interesting chapter, I think it's in The Human Cycle, on the suprarational. There's the suprarational good, but there's also the suprarational something of life. It's a marvelous chapter where he explains all about the dangers, why the spiritual life has tended to reject life, and why that's not part of his yoga, and why life is so important. Because it brings dynamism, it brings force and strength, which enables us to go very high, even though there's the danger of going very low. Yes, that's what he says, contrary powers. Yes. Yes. And we live in a world of duality, and unfortunately we live in a human consciousness that is bounded by ignorance. So it's difficult for us to see the truth in these oppositions. Sri Aurobindo puts it, he says, they seem to have found it was so difficult to deal with that they came to the conclusion that it was better to avoid it, to avoid these intensities altogether.
When you run away when the tsunami is coming.
Yeah. There's something in the ascetic impulse which turns away from all this. The bhakta tries to turn all this passion and intensity into love towards the divine. But if we're pursuing the sattvic path, we will find that Savitri comes to a place where this life force is under the control of mind. It's controlled by reason. Human beings tend to think that that's much safer if we are not indulging all the time in if we don't allow ourselves to be carried away by this tsunami of life force, this dragon of life force. So that's very true. We should not, and Savitri does not. She sees all this, that she's firm like a rock in the midst of these waves.
Maybe starting familiar from my impression, not impression, but experience, earlier. Somebody entered into the inner country and suddenly
they get carried away. It can happen,
when you
yes.
Express about,
yes. It can happen.
In the matter
yes.
Is exactly.
Yes.
Suddenly is a totally familiar.
That's why Sri Aurobindo's telling us about it here.
He's very, very.
Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm. That's when we need the protection.
Yeah.
When we start to enter into the inner countries, we need the protection and the guidance and the grace.
But for me, also, in my inner experience, and mother, not only Shobindo, but mother also, it depends when I turn my.
Which way you turn. Shall we read just a little bit further? Ellen, would you like to read? Line 201, mind's quick-paced thoughts.
Mind's quick-paced thoughts floated from the high necks. A glowing splendor of an irised gleam. A arrow of pure intuition's light. Its flame foot galloped, it foot imitating. Mind's voices mimic inspiration's guest. Its ictus of infallibility, its speed enlightening heaven black of the god, a transient blade that shore the nets of doubt, its sword of discernment seemed almost divine. Yet all that knowledge was a borrowed sense. The forms that came were not heaven's native birth. An inner voice could speak the unreal words, its persons dangerous and absolute, could mingle poison with the vine of God. On this high shining path falsehood could ride. Truth lay his delight in Eros' passionate arms. Gliding downstream in blithe,
a blithe, gilded barge.
She etched her reign with a magnificent
light. Thank you. So this is what happens when the mind is carried away by the life force, or influenced by the life force. Wonderful thoughts come, like shining horses, and they have these manes, lovely manes of rainbow color, glowing, irised, means all the colors of the rainbow. And so we mistake them for pure intuition. They have that glow, that they're wearing that appearance of pure intuition. Parure is a set of jewelry, I think. Yes? No, I don't think it has to be fake. In the story, it turns out to be fake. In the Guy de Maupassant story.
A set of ornaments. It says here a set of coordinated jewels.
Yeah, you have a tiara and earrings and necklaces and bracelets. And they all match. It's a set of jewels. I think that's it. So anyway, all that looks very good. That looks like the pure light of intuition, those shining diamonds. And those horses, the horses of the mind driven by the life energy, they can imitate the flame foot gallop of intuition. And then the voices of the mind, they mimic, they copy, they pretend, they have the same sound as pure inspiration. And the thing about inspiration, when the mantra comes, that's the inevitable word. It has an ictus of infallibility. The ictus is the sign that indicates that here the stress has to be put, the rhythm. It's speed and lightning, heavenly of the gods. So this can be very dangerous. The thought then becomes like a sword, a trenchant blade that can cut through all the nets of doubt. You're absolutely sure because the thought has come in such a powerful way. And this sword of discernment seems almost divine. The sword of discernment of telling the truth from the false. But all this is a borrowed sense. It's not the real thing. The forms that came were not heaven's native birds. They haven't been born on the higher levels. You may hear an inner voice, but it may be speaking the word of the unreal. So when there's this vital mixture, that dangerous and absolute power can mix in poison, even with the divine nectar, the wine of God.
There's an interesting addition here in the explanation of Ictus.
Yes, what does he say?
He says, Sherbino may here be carrying over the sense of the Latin phrase Ictus Solus, meaning a stroke of the sun.
Would you speak
slowly? I'm sorry. Okay, that Sherbino, he says, is carrying the sense of a Latin phrase called Ictus Solus.
Sunstroke.
Yeah, a stroke of the sun.
Mm-hmm.
Is it ordinary, means ordinary sunstroke also? He says it means naturally and suddenly illumines. So an ictus is like this. It's like
sudden illumination.
Illumination.
Okay, nice. Thanks, Rand Hicks. So with these shining horses, falsehood could ride them. And there's this mixture, truth, happily lying in the passionate arms of error, gliding downstream in a blithe, gilded barge. It's a image of Cleopatra, beautiful golden barge floating downstream. Truth can edge her ray, her ictus, with a magnificent lie. So we'll stop there for today. Yes, please.
Truth stares and does her works with bandaged eyes.
If your eyes are bandaged, you can't see. And we have this picture of justice. You know that?
Yeah?
Her eyes are bandaged. She has to just weigh the truth. She can't see. She must not be influenced by who is petitioning her. Here in our world, truth doesn't have that power of truth vision which it has on the higher levels. Especially if the life force is very strong. But here it says in life's nether realms, here in the lower realms of life, all contraries meet. And here she stares, she has to try hard to see. But she's doing her work with bandaged eyes, without the power of complete vision. Ignorance is wisdom's patrons here. We'll read that next week. We'll go into all that next time.
Then
so increase surge dealt of her body's wall, and stood a little span outside herself. At the dim portal of the inner life, a formidable voice cried from within, "That creature of earth, less tortured and torn thereby." The serpent of the threshold hissing rose, and trolls and gnomes and goblins scowled and stared, and wild beast roarings thrilled the blood with fear. And menace muttered in a dangerous tongue, unshaken her will pressed on the rigid bars. Her being entered into the inner world. Across a perilous borderline, she passed, where her life dips into the subconscious dust. All struggles from matter into chaos of mind. A swarm with demented entities and fluttering shapes, a vague half-bodied thought, and crude beginnings of incontinent force. This state now threatened. Thus she pushed from her. Approaching loomed a giant head of life, ungoverned by mind or soul, subconscious vast.
Thanks to Chopin.